Today at Reader's Corner, we talk to Angela Stent, author of Putin's World, Russia Against the West and With the Rest. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. On the home front, Russia is a nation in turmoil, a flagging economy, shrinking population, with some rural areas that still don't have running water. Yet Russia has emerged from the ashes of post-Soviet communism as an international broker of mediation and disruption led by President Vladimir Putin. How did Russia manage to reappear on the world stage and play a weak hand so effectively? In her book, Putin's World, author and foreign policy expert Angela Stent examines the country's turbulent past, how it has influenced Putin, the Russians' understanding of their position on the global stage, and their future international ambitions. Angela Stent is director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and Eastern European Studies and a professor of government and foreign service at Georgetown University. From 2004 to 2006, she served as national intelligence officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council. She is the author of The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century. Angela Stent, welcome to Reader's Corner.
I'm delighted to be on your program.
Well, let's start with that famous 1991 event when communism fell. Russia is an independent state. And at that moment, the West seemed to think that democracy was going to take its place. That didn't exactly happen that way. In fact, you have a quote somewhere in your book that I picked up while reading it that I thought may sum it all up. Before the Russians were communist, they were Russians, and they still are. Could you explain how that may explain why democracy didn't fall in place so easily in Russia?
Yes, so I think we thought when the Soviet Union collapsed that the problem with the Soviet Union was that it was a Soviet system and it adhered to this Marxist-Leninist ideology. And it really turns out that one of the problems of dealing with it, and this is why we see a Russia that doesn't seem to want to embrace a Western-style democracy, is because they're Russians. And by that I mean, you know, you have a history, you have maybe a millennium of a history of rule either by czars or for 74 years of communism by first general secretaries, and now again we have an authoritarian leader. So that has certainly been the tradition. And I think the other issue is, if you look back in Russia's history, as I say in the book, there's no history, no precedent for Russian leaders voluntarily accepting that they've lost territory. They may lose territory sometimes, but they always take it back again. And therefore, I think if we thought that post-Soviet Russia would be content to say, okay, we lost Ukraine and those post-Soviet states, then I think we were quite wrong because we just didn't look enough back into their history and understand that this would really be alien to them.
So Putin then should come as no great surprise to us as the kind of strong man that would succeed. But I wonder if you could share with us, as you do in your book, the role of his judo expertise and how that fits into the man and to the strong man in Russia.
So, you know, you yourself said Russia has managed to punch above its weight. How was it able to do that? And one of the things that we know about Vladimir Putin is, you know, he was born into a pretty poor household. He was kind of an indifferent student in the beginning in school. And then, as he himself says in an autobiographical essay that was published when he first became president in 2000, he says, you know, judo really was my way out of this. He discovered the martial arts, and he excelled in them. He won a championship. In fact, in my book, I have a picture of an article from the Leningrad Evening newspaper in 1976 talking about this 24-year-old judo champion. Now, in judo, you may be physically weaker than your opponent, but if you understand your opponent's weaknesses, you understand when he's distracted, you can still move in and you can still prevail over him. And so I think we see in Putin a very savvy judo player, probably plus the training he received as a case officer in the KGB, understanding how to take advantage of opportunities that are presented to him by a distracted West and by a United States that always doesn't know what it wants.
And Putin is also an ex-KGB man. How does that inform us as to what kind of leader he would be or is?
Well, I think, you know, he came from the KGB, and for the KGB, you know, the main enemy was the West, the main enemy was the United States, the main enemy was NATO. And I think that that mentality hasn't really gone away. The first leader of post-Soviet Russia, Boris Yeltsin, didn't come from that background. And he was much more willing, at least in the beginning, to reach out to the West and to try and explore how Russia and the U.S. could get closer together. But given Putin's training, that really wouldn't have been part of his mindset. And when he came to power in 2000, he promised that he would first of all restore Russia as a strong state, which means having a much more authoritarian leader, but then also as a great global power. And he's achieved both of those.
You mentioned NATO. Let's talk about NATO for a moment. Of course, President Trump hasn't been too fond of NATO in some of his comments. And we interviewed Stephen Walt here on at Reader's Corner a few weeks ago about his book, The Hell of Good Intentions. I'm sure you know him or are aware of his work anyway.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, you know, he attacks liberal hegemony and is really talking about restraint in so many of his writings. In fact, he wrote for Foreign Affairs and he said he listed a whole series of issues, Russia seizing Crimea, China and Russia being much more cooperative with each other than ever before, the UK's decision to draw from the EU. And at the end of it, he says, the United States was not solely responsible for all these adverse developments, but it played a major role in most of them. And one of them that he cites is the fact that U.S. strategy, apparently, or the West strategy, was to take NATO and enlarge it considerably by bringing in countries that, according to Walt anyway, would obviously antagonize Putin and have Putin believe that the West is just trying to creep right on up to his doorstep. Could you comment on what you think of this NATO today, and should we have admitted all of these Eastern European countries in those days, and given the impact that it apparently has had on Putin's thinking?
Yeah, well, I have to say that I disagree with Professor Walt's argument. You have to think back to the end of the Cold War. The Soviet Union collapses. You have all these countries in Central Europe that have really themselves barely ever experienced democracy. Most of them, in fact, hadn't. They'd either been part of an empire or the Nazis occupied them and then the Soviets took over. And so what was going to happen to all of these countries that lay between Russia and the West? And we were very worried. The West was very worried that, you know, you could have even seen, for instance, a war between Hungary and Romania, who have territorial disputes with each other. So one of the main reasons for enlarging NATO in the 1990s was to try and get all of these countries to be in an organization where they'd renounce these kind of irredentist claims, and that would anchor them in the security system. And they wanted to join NATO. You know, these are countries that had been occupied by Russia and the Soviet Union in different forms for centuries, some of them, and they wanted to be in NATO. The problem then was, what do you do about Russia? And of course, when NATO began to enlarge, it was made clear to Russia that if Russia was interested in joining NATO and if it would undertake policies that were necessary to join NATO, it could one day join NATO. But of course, that was really a very tall order at that point. So at that point, it was very difficult to satisfy the security needs of Central European countries and then those of Russia who said, well, they didn't want NATO to enlarge, or why didn't NATO disband itself? Russia is the largest country on the world. It's not clear what its place is in a Euro-Atlantic system like that. And I think the Russians have used this argument about NATO threatening them post facto. In the 1990s, they didn't really object to it. Putin didn't really object in 2004 when the Baltic states and other countries were admitted to NATO. And so now to blame everything on NATO enlargement, I think, is just to misunderstand history and misunderstand the benefits that enlarging NATO brought.
Now, one of the strange developments along these lines is that two of those countries, Poland and Hungary, have grown quite cozy these days with Russia. We just interviewed a gentleman who wrote a book called A Covert Action, which is the story of Reagan's effort to undermine the communist in Poland when Lech Wałęsa was trying to free it from communist rule. And now, of course, as everyone knows, Poland and Hungary has turned significantly to the right. What magic has Putin himself worked to get countries formerly under communist rule who were seeking their freedom but now seem to be turning their backs on it and turning to the strong man, Putin. Is that to Putin's credit, or are those just things going on internally in Poland and Hungary?
Well, I think you have to differentiate, right? Hungary has certainly grown closer to Russia. Poland has not.
Yeah.
I mean, the Poles are still very suspicious of the Russians, and they want to have a U.S. base there for Trump. But the broader question is, why have Poland and Hungary, and particularly Poland, which seemed to be such a model democracy 10 years ago, why have they moved in the direction that they have? And I think that part of the answer to this is what I said earlier on, that none of these countries had ever experienced democracy, really. And in the interwar period, when they were independent between 1918 and 1939, they all had authoritarian governments. And so what you see happening there is people kind of going back to episodes in their history that they haven't worked out yet. And in Hungary's case, Viktor Orban is an authoritarian leader by now. He doesn't like the European Union, although he's still staying in it. And he certainly has turned toward Russia, has improved ties with Russia in a very populist government. In Poland, it's less authoritarian than it is in Hungary, and I think the possibility for change there back to something that looks more democratic is definitely there. But Poland so far has certainly not moved closer to Russia.
When it comes to Putin's role, his increasing global role as a power broker, what role does the presidencies of George Bush and Barack Obama play in this? What successes and failures during those two administrations prior to Trump's can we point to that may suggest how Putin manages to be so successful?
So every U.S. president since the collapse of the Soviet Union has come into office believing that they can find a much better way to interact with Russia. That there's, if only, you can adopt a different policy, then the relationship with Russia will improve. And actually, the Russian leaders will say that the same is true, that they've hoped too to find, if you like, the magic key. So under President George W. Bush, in the beginning, it worked out quite well. Russia supported the United States after the 9/11 attacks. They were very helpful in the fall of 2001 in the initial defeat of the Taliban in Afghanistan, because Putin thought that what he would get in this new relationship with President Bush was an equal partnership of unequals. He wanted the United States to treat Russia as an equal, even though he understood that militarily, economically, etc., Russia was the weaker party. And that worked for a while. But then things started to go wrong with the invasion of Iraq, color revolutions in some of Russia's neighbors, Ukraine and Georgia, and then finally culminating in Russia's war with Georgia in 2008. So I would say the two terms of George Bush's presidency, I think, consolidated for Putin after his disappointment about what he expected from this improved relationship with the United States. It sort of consolidated his determination to push for something else. And in 2007, he made a speech at the Munich Security Conference, basically attacking the United States for trying to impose its will on everyone else. So by that time, he had carved out the space for himself as the leader of those countries that didn't want the U.S. to impose its will on them. Then, of course, Barack Obama comes in, and he is determined that there will be a reset with Russia. And in the first 4 years, the first Obama term, things work much better. Why? Because President Putin, constitutionally unable to have a third term at that point, had switched jobs with the prime minister, Dmitry Medvedev. And so Putin became prime minister and Dmitry Medvedev became the president, even though Putin himself was exercising a lot of power. But President Obama and President Medvedev got on. They were both of a younger generation. They maybe wanted something different. And they managed to sign a New START, an arms control agreement, and various other agreements on Iran and Afghanistan. And things seemed to be going pretty well. And then things went downhill again when Putin announced that he was going back to the Kremlin after 4 years. He'd switched jobs again with Medvedev. The Russian population, at least the urbanites in Moscow and other places, were furious about this, as if they hadn't been consulted about that. There were huge demonstrations in the fall, in the December of 2011, in the streets. And who did Putin blame for these demonstrations against him? Hillary Clinton. Right. He said that she had paid for all of those demonstrators to go out in the street. So I think that's a time when Putin was even more determined. And after that, they threw out a lot of American NGOs who were operating in Russia. And they also saw Hillary Clinton then as really an enemy, an adversary. And that, I think, partly explains what they did in 2016.
You know, as you talk about the way Putin took after Hillary and blamed her for the incitement of the troops, so to speak, in the streets, I can't help but think about the fact that you talk about the young people of Russia. What's tomorrow for Russia? What are young people thinking? We had an Arab Spring not too long ago. It didn't work out so well, unfortunately. But it was young people that took to the streets and took to social media and made things happen. I believe I got the sense from reading your book that Putin is so effective as a propaganda strongman that the Russian people, again, buying into the what you call the Russian idea, are not exactly looking for democracy at this stage in their history.
So you have an entire generation now, the Putin generation of young people. Putin's been in power nearly 20 years, who've never known another leader than Putin. And some of those young people just kind of accept this is the way it is, and they go about their lives, and they understand that there are really limits to what they can say. But you also see increasingly now young people being willing to move beyond that. The Russian economy isn't doing that well. The prospects for young people coming out with a degree, without a degree, whatever, their job prospects aren't as good as they used to be. The standard of living isn't growing as it used to be. And what you've seen now, in even high schoolers have responded to the call of one of the big anti-corruption crusaders. He's called Alexei Navalny. He's an opponent of Putin. And he's managed to mobilize kids to go out in the streets locally to complain about local corruption. So that's something that does motivate these young people when they understand that, you know, the people who run the country own most of the country and have these fantastic houses and whatever, and there they are. You know, they don't know whether they're going to be able to get a job. And then just recently, a journalist, a muckraking journalist who was exposing corruption at this point, this had to do with the funeral industry in Moscow and its ties to various people in the government, was suddenly arrested, and they planted drugs on him and said that he was a drug seller, and they hauled him off to jail. And there was a huge outcry against that. And a lot of people, even though they couldn't have a big demonstration, sort of individually went and held placards outside of the courts and protested his arrest. And eventually, he was actually freed, and the police chief who'd been responsible for his arrest was fired. So we're seeing now more activism among youth, certainly in the cities and beyond the cities, but you shouldn't exaggerate it because I think still the disincentives for people to protest and to criticize are pretty strong. And it'll be interesting to see whether they succeed. Is the Russian government trying to cut the Russians off from the global internet? They're now trying to do what the Chinese, of course, have done for a long time. Whether they can succeed, I don't know, because Russians are also pretty talented at hacking and getting around these restrictions. But they're trying to isolate their own population more.
Well, we certainly know that the Russians are good at hacking, given the 2016 election. Is there a clear picture of how Putin might have been involved in that operation?
Well, you know, that's a very controversial, because the declassified version of the Intelligence Committee's report on this in 2016 said that Putin ordered the interference in the election.
Right.
But now I believe that the Attorney General, Mr. Barr, they're reviewing all those findings, and they're trying to figure out exactly how they got to the conclusion that Putin was behind it. And obviously, the Russians have denied this, and Putin himself has denied it. So we don't really know very much about where that conclusion came from.
You know, one of the things that really surprised me, and maybe I should have known this, but as I'm reading along, you're talking about the Russian economy, as you've just commented, and you mentioned that it's smaller than Italy's?
It is.
That's amazing.
It's smaller than Italy's, exactly.
Yeah.
What they're good at doing is, you know, punching above their weight. They can deploy military power, you know, on the cheap, as they've done in Syria and Venezuela and places like that. But their economy itself, for a country of 140 million people, is pretty small.
Mm-hmm. And help us understand the role that oil and gas revenues play in that economy, because that apparently is a large part of it, that when it comes to shipping oil and gas to the West, so to speak.
Sure. So 60% of their budget comes from oil and gas sales. So they are really a petrostate, and they're dependent on exports of oil and gas. And they also have the largest reserves, potentially, of both of those commodities in the world. And sometimes they're the largest producer, and sometimes they're not. It depends on what day you're looking at. But oil, you know, is obviously sold on a global market. Gas, it has, of course, become quite controversial because a lot of the gas they sell is by pipeline to Europe. And, you know, the Europeans, depending on the country, like Germany, Italy, they get about 40% of their natural gas consumption from Russia. They're about to complete building another pipeline which bypasses Ukraine. They used to export 80% of the gas to Europe via Ukraine, but because of all the issues, there's a war between Russia and Ukraine. They're cutting that down now and trying to build another pipeline that will bypass Ukraine. Ukraine will lose the revenue. So we have the Trump administration, which is threatening sanctions on the companies in Europe that are helping build that. That's controversial. Meanwhile, the Chinese, after we imposed sanctions on Russia in 2014 following the annexation of Crimea, they signed a $400 billion gas deal with Russia. And so Russia is now exporting much more gas to China. That pipeline isn't really complete, and they're talking about another one. So their gas exports were always focused on the West, but now increasingly on the East.
Mm-hmm. Well, I noticed as you covered the relationship between Putin's Russia and China, you pointed out that the Russian embassy in China is Russia's largest embassy in the world. And I was going to ask you, how is that symbolic of a new bilateral partnership between Russia and China? I guess oil and gas is part of that answer, right?
Oil and gas is part of the answer, but it's much more than that. You know, for the first time last year, Chinese troops participated in Russian military maneuvers in the Far East. Really, China has stepped in since the crisis in Ukraine began, and since the West imposed sanctions on Russia, China's really stepped in to bolster Russia and to make it impossible for the West to isolate Russia. And I also think that the kind of dual policies of the Trump administration, which is rafts of sanctions on Russia and a trade war with China, have also pushed those two countries closer together. But that relationship really has improved. If you think about it, 50 years ago, Soviet and Chinese troops were shooting each other over the border. People thought that there'd be a war between Russia and China, and now each leader describes the other one as their best friend. And I think this is a relationship that one has to take very seriously, even though it's an unequal relationship, because clearly China's a rising power and Russia isn't. But it has become much stronger in the past 5 years.
You mentioned the U.S. sanctions against Russia. They were slapped on Putin, of course. And you point out that that actually strengthens his hand. How does that happen?
So if the West thought, if the U.S. thought that by sanctioning, you know, people who are close to Putin and freezing their assets and giving them visa bans so they can't visit Europe or the United States, that this would somehow make these people get together and say, well, we've got to have another leader because we don't like this. That's not how it works in Russia. And, you know, the people around Putin are dependent on him for the assets they have. And so what's happened with these personal sanctions against Russians is that they have become more dependent, really, on state handouts to make sure that they can continue functioning. They've had to bring some of their money back to Russia that was overseas. And we see no signs that any of these sanctions on these individuals have changed Russian policy.
So you talk about the near abroad in your book. Russia has 14 new land neighbors, as you call them. Some are friends. Some are what we might want to call problem children. And let's talk about, first of all, I'll let you decide what allies you might want to focus on. Belarus comes to mind, and certainly as a problem child, Chechnya comes to mind. But could you address this newfound relationship? It's not brand new, of course, but that Russia had to develop and perfect as a result of the downfall of communism. These independent nations went a variety of directions.
Sure. So I think when the Soviet Union collapsed, for a time they didn't even have a department in the Russian Foreign Ministry to deal with these countries because they didn't think about them as far abroad countries, which is why they call them the near abroad, that they're not really foreign countries. Now, in some of the countries in Central Asia, a country like Turkmenistan or even Kazakhstan, I think it's easier for the Russians to accept that these are foreign countries, but with a special relationship to Russia. The most problematic one, of course, is Ukraine. Putin has said on several occasions that Ukraine isn't really a country, that half of Ukraine used to be part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the other half part of the Russian Empire, and they don't belong together, and certainly the eastern half should be part of Russia. So, and here we see a war going on, and I think that the Russians maybe have miscalculated there, because I think this crisis with Ukraine and the war there has done more to consolidate Ukrainian national identity than anything else before it. So Ukraine is probably the number one kind of enemy in that area, if you like. Georgia is another very problematic country for Russia, and we've seen riots in Georgia because there was a Russian parliamentary delegation visiting Georgia, and the Georgians objected to that. So Russia occupies part of Georgian territories after the 2008 war. So I would say that for those two countries, that's the most antagonistic relationship. Belarus is technically a Russian ally. They have a union treaty. But actually, the relationship with Belarus is pretty frayed at the moment. And you've seen its leader, Alexander Lukashenko, who's known as the last dictator of Europe. You know, they've never adopted capitalism. They've still got a Soviet-style economic system. But he's turning increasingly now to the European Union and putting out feelers because the Belarusians feel pressed by Russia. And some people believe that what Vladimir Putin wants to do is, in 2024, when he's supposed to leave office, that he will have a new role for himself, and that will be as a president of the new Belarusian-Russian unitary state. I don't think that's what Lukashenko wants, and therefore we should watch the spot going forward.
I was fascinated by your discussion of the relationship between Russia and Japan, and especially the Kuril Islands. And of course, Prime Minister Abe is trying to get Putin over to Japan as many times as possible, gave him some big judo award that you mentioned in your book. But of course, Putin, in the meantime, is getting a bit of domestic pressure, I guess you could call it, from back home. Don't give up the islands. And it raises the question, even though Russia is far from a democracy, as to what kinds of pressures back home from people in the streets or wherever they are, whether it's a newspaper or whatever, what kind of pressure does that place on Putin? And even though it may not be a democracy, does a strong man like Putin have to be very careful when he's off cutting deals with foreign countries if people back home aren't satisfied with them?
I think he certainly does. You know, now the Japanese are all saying, we understand this isn't going to work out. We really hope we'd get a deal. Putin has appealed to nationalism increasingly with the Russian population, really since the Ukrainian events. And I think the vast majority of Russians by now, you know, they believe what they see on their state-run television, and they believe that, you know, Russia is a great country and it shouldn't give up territory. And therefore, you have, I think, public opinion surveys showing that more than 70% of the Russian population think that Russia shouldn't even give up two, admittedly, rather small islands back to Japan, which would presumably release more Japanese investment and everything for Russia. So I think on those kinds of issues, Putin does listen to public opinion. You know, when we talk about opposition to Putin, we often think about just the democratic opposition, but there's also nationalistic opposition to Putin. There are people in Russia who think he should have gone further in Ukraine, and he has to be very worried about, if you like, about his right flank as well as, you know, the people, the democracy activists in what he does, and I think the Japan case is a very good example of it.
So Putin is in his third term, heading for his fourth, isn't that correct?
He's in his fourth term.
He's in fourth now.
He's in his fourth term, and technically he should step down in 2024.
Mm-hmm. Is that going to happen?
I don't know too many Russians who believe that it will. So some people believe he'll try and do what the Kazakh leader, Mr. Nazarbayev, has just done, which is that he'll technically leave the Kremlin and he'll put somebody else in there. But he'll have a new role, the head of some new organization, and that he will still wield a lot of power and influence in the country. He's less likely to change the Constitution, because until now he's been a stickler for the Constitution. But every so often you'll see, you know, members of the Parliament, the Duma, say, oh, we've got to change the Constitution so that he can stay in office longer. A less likely option, I think, is a managed transition where he picks a successor, but the successor essentially lets everybody keep what they have and leaves everybody alone, which is what he did when he took over from Yeltsin. But it's much harder to do that now. So obviously he can surprise, and he often does. But as I say, I don't know too many Russians who think that he'll be gone from the scene in 2024.
Do you have any thoughts on what America can expect in 2020 when it comes to presidential election interference?
Well, so far, the Russians haven't stopped interfering in our elections. They were certainly interfering up till the day before the midterms last November, and we read in the papers that the U.S. Cyber Command had to undertake some actions to try and stop that. So I think you have to expect that they'll continue, both via social media and presumably via cyber, to interfere. You know, if it were possible, they say they're willing to sit down and try and work out rules of the road on these issues. So far, nobody's taken them up on it. I doubt that that would really happen before the 2020 election. So I think that the message there is that they will still try and interfere. And what the U.S. has to do is to just be as vigilant as it can and have to have the proper robust defenses against that to ensure that they don't have too much of an impact.
Well, we've run out of time, but I didn't manage to get through every last chapter of your book, Angela, and I regret that, because there's some great chapters in here about Russia's relationship with the Middle East and Russia's relationship with Germany and some of the other Western European countries. But I'm going to leave that to our listeners. This is a great analysis. Putin's World, Russia Against the West and With the Rest, by Angela Stent. Thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much.
Join us next week as we talk to Essie Adugian about her novel, Washington Black. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.